engineering school,
which is responsible for the development of military weapons that have been used in the to enforce the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and to commit war crimes against Palestine and Palestinians. So this is a lot more than an engineering school, and frankly, we can't really be sure that Cornell NYC Tech is simply an engineering school, because the plans for the curriculum have been kept very secret. And we are wondering why, for example, Cornell and the Technion have been so secretive about what they're going to be doing. This deal was fast-tracked by the city in collaboration with Cornell and the Technion. Fact that $100 million of New York City taxpayer money was given to the project was also kept from the public. I mean, the decision was pushed through by fiat.
Ginsburg says they plan to keep doing these biweekly protests outside Google on 8th Avenue.
We have protests planned on Roosevelt Island. We've been contacting the architects who are slated to design the campus on Roosevelt Island and the faculty members who have already been hired to teach there. We have a petition online that people can sign that is going to be sent to relevant New York City and state elected officials, asking them not to support this project, in fact, to block it. And there are many other projects in the works that we plan to do. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, and our main goal right now is to educate the public about the fact that this is happening, because most people really don't know that it's going on.
The New York City Council has yet to hold a hearing or vote on the project. And that's our abbreviated newscast for Wednesday, March the 27th, 2013. We're still broadcasting from home-built locations around the city. The news was produced in New York with Reggie Johnson, Linda Perry, Andrea Sears, and Jose Santiago. I'm Rebecca Miles for the WBAI Evening News in New York.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
On Friday, April 5th, from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, WBAI will air a report to the listener. Listen and learn about WBAI's future by listening to A Report to the Listener on Friday, March 5th, from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. Don't miss it.
Freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. The beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When the world stop and listen, when will we all stop and see? We've been missing. that the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop enlisting? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. There's life, there's still a day, and I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
You are tuned to Earthwatch on WBAI New York, and tonight we go deep on the. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. Tonight we go deep on the Gulf of Mexico oil leak, the volcanic eruption of an ecocidal stream of dimensions obscured by the government and by the perpetrator. Well, should I even make a distinction between the two? In tonight's program, we're going to be speaking with quite a number of people about the dirty details that have been resistant to exposure to the American public. It appears that the government is opposed to the release of hazardous information. And in tonight's program, we will look at why that is, and we will find that there is little difference between the Gulf of Mexico and the Persian Gulf. We'll expose the British Petroleum connection between President Obama's inactivity in truthfully and fully exercising the prerogatives of his office to be truthful with the American public and to ensure the most economical and efficient way of addressing this nationally unprecedented disaster, one that was initiated by himself when on the 31st of March of this year, he authorized the expanded drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and on the Atlantic coast and in Alaska that led in 18 days after his announcement to this travesty of nature that is taking place. Oh, thank you. That must be a pleasure. Appreciate that. WBAI in New York, there may be a couple of people left in the tally of the volunteer room, and so give it a shot, 212-209-2950 to support this station during its annual spring drive. WBAI has never been more important than it is now. And in case you cannot, like those callers, get through, you can go online to WBAI.org and select Earth Watch or any other program you choose to support WBAI and keep a dissident voice of truth and investigation operating on these precious airwaves. Now, as I was saying, it was President Obama, not President Bush, who unleashed the Gulf oil drilling. to the devastating results that we are seeing now. On the 31st of March, Obama said, "Today we are announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration. Under the leadership of Secretary Salazar, we'll employ new technologies that reduce the impact of oil exploration." Obama said, "We'll protect areas that are vital to tourism, to the environment, and to our national security." Obama said, "That's why my administration will consider potential areas for development in the Mid and South Atlantic and in the Gulf of Mexico." We're going to be all over that tonight, and we're going to look at the relationship between devastation in the Gulf of Mexico and Obama's greater-than-Bush expansion of the war in Afghanistan, and how British petroleum relates to that. So do stay tuned. We note also that we have been covering the remarkable developments in the occupied nation of Haiti under United Nations military occupation at the moment. And in the past weeks and months, we have presented one of the most successful premium incentive packages for your subscription to WBAI in the form of The Sweet Science of Racism in Haiti. And we're working on the sequel to that, and that is called Monsanto and the New Genetic Servitude in Haiti, and that is about the imposition of hybrid seeds and the pesticidal regime that accompanies their use, and the resistance of peasant farmers in Haiti to that. And over this past weekend, despite the skepticism of some, there was a tremendous, one of the largest demonstrations against this policy and this program of imposing a corporate-supplied seed regime that would have the effect of pretty much killing the indigenous seed banks and stocks that are so important to self-sufficiency in Haiti. And we spoke with Siobhan Jean-Baptiste on the night before a major protest with more than 10,000 people, not in Port-au-Prince, but in central Haiti, where many Western reporters are not familiar, or very few go. But some of those who did were from Agence France-Presse. And in the land of the high mountains, I'd like to, before we move on to the Mexican Gulf and perhaps return to Haiti later in the program, share this Agence France-Presse report by Alice Berry from Hinche in central Haiti. Thousands rally against the government and Monsanto. And it reads as follows. Thousands of farmers marched in this city to protest against the government of President René Préval and the involvement of multinational company Monsanto in Haiti's rural areas. The demonstration came in response to the announcement that Monsanto will distribute some 475 tons of maize to Haitian farmers in cooperation with Project Winner, a USAID, that's the Agency for International Development, initiative which aims to increase the country's agricultural productivity. Wearing red shirts and straw hats sprayed in signs against Préval and Monsanto, people from all districts gathered at the center of the Mouvement Paysien Papaye, the MPP, a forming cooperative and one of the leading organizations in Haiti's peasant movement. Hundreds more joined the rally in Hinche's central square, where under a scorching sun, demonstrators chanted, "Down with Préval, keep Monsanto out of Haiti," and the occasional "Down with the occupation." Speaking to a cheering crowd, our friend Jean-Baptiste Chavon, who you heard on this air last week before the event, he said, "The Haitian government is using the earthquake to sell the country to the multinationals." He's the coordinator of the MPP movement, as previously noted, and as BAI listeners already know. He said, "We have to fight for our local seeds. We have to defend our food sovereignty." The Hinche rally underscores the precarious nature of Haiti's political and social fabric, since the January earthquake destroyed the country's largest city, Port-au-Prince. It also raises the prickly issue of product dumping on a people who already feel vulnerable because of the level of devastation brought on by the earthquake, which killed an estimated 300,000 people and left 1.5 million homeless. Préval has been under attack from the tattered opposition that has managed to stage weekly protests in front of the crumbled National Palace every Monday. Opposition leaders have vowed to protest until Préval says definitely that he will leave office when his term expires in February, although he didn't take office until May because of, well, so many interferences from the United States and related parties. Organizers estimated the number of demonstrators to reach several thousands. Organizers say as many as 12 or 13,000. They gave away all of the 10,000 hats that they had made for the event. Delegations from Brazil, the Dominican Republic, the United States, and representatives of international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, also came to show solidarity with the Haitian farmers. "This is not just about the seeds," said Samuel Smith, a 74-year-old organic farmer and longtime supporter of local agriculture who came to the rally from Massachusetts. He said it's about imposing on people a system that they cannot get rid of, that they cannot get out of. Haiti's Ministry of Agriculture neglected to inform farmers about the risks associated with growing hybrid or treated seeds. Monsanto is currently denying that the current shipment, this is parenthetical, Monsanto, and for reasons of precision, I point out that Monsanto says that the seeds that are currently being sent are not specifically genetically modified. But Jean-Baptiste said that it doesn't matter because it's still destructive to the indigenous stores of seeds and agriculture there. Now, continuing from Agence France-Presse, representatives of the peasant movement fear Monsanto will take advantage of Haiti's fragile situation and corrupt political leaders to support such products as they have in the past, for instance, in Indonesia and around the world, including Oregon. "The seeds that Monsanto is donating to Haiti are not genetically modified," said a Monsanto spokesperson. "They are of a conventional hybrid seeds that are already grown in the Dominican Republic." Monsanto donated $255,000 for disaster relief and says that it's committed to the success of Haitian farmers. That, according to Monsanto Vice President Jerry Stein, in a letter to Haiti's Minister of Agriculture, Joannas Gu. "People in Haiti do not know much about Monsanto," participants at the rally admitted, "but groups like the MPP and six other organizations of Haitian farmers have been working on warning local peasants about Monsanto's donation, including by screening educational documentaries. Though the seeds were donated, they are already being sold in Port-au-Prince. Haiti does not have a law regulating the use of genetically modified organisms." Jean-Baptiste said of Monsanto's offer, "This is a gift of death. It's an attack on peasant agriculture, on the farmers, on biodiversity, on native seeds, and on what remains of our environment in Haiti," end quote. Participants at the Hinche rally also came out to show their discontent with the government. Pierre Charité said, "I'm here because I'm angry with Préval." Charité is a 61-year-old farmer from the Central Plateau. He grows maize, plantains, and sugarcane and pistachios. He said, "They accepted corn that is bad. That will kill the Haitian corn. I will not use that," end quote. Ronel Odette, a local radio commentator, said, "The government will have to take notice of this. Today it's in Hinche. Tomorrow it'll be somewhere else. This is really a national movement," end quote. That is from the Agence France-Presse reportage of the event we told you was going to happen and have 10,000 people here on WBAI, on Earthwatch, and doing our fund raising last Thursday. And thank you all for the support. And you still have a few minutes, a little while now, to get in on not only the sweet science of Haiti, but to get the groundbreaking new documentary that will be in an even more accelerated format than the history of racism in Haiti, called Monsanto and the New Genetic Servitude in Haiti by maybe you can reach someone at 212-209-2950, but the real secure and sure way to do that and support the station is by going online to the website, wbai.org, and there are some precise and careful details to help you through all of that. So this is just a bulletin on what's happening in Haiti. That's one of our areas of interest, and the other, of course, and devastating story that we're going to be going all over tonight is, of course, the ecocide of the Gulf of Mexico, precipitated by President Obama's green lighting of British Petroleum to continue in its reckless and unregulated ways. And that stuff is going to be coming to New York. The loop current is going to take it out of the Gulf. It's going to go around Florida and then north along the Atlantic coast. And some people here in the New York tri-state metropolitan area are not only concerned about that, but they're doing something about it. Here are some details coming up on that. Just one more important note I'd like to share on the subject of Haiti before we move into the Gulf. And that is, the leader of this remarkable protest, or one of the main leaders of it, Haitian peasant leader, Chauvin Jean-Baptiste, who you heard on this show, on this radio station, will be in New York this weekend. And I invite all of you who listen or who have been following this story to join us this Saturday, June 12th, at 5:30 p.m. in a very special meeting. He's coming into the country for this very purpose, and it's going to be very important. The meeting is on Saturday, June 12th, 2010, at 5:30 p.m. at the Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church, 85 South Oxford Street, Brooklyn, 11217. Come and learn about the Haitian farmer's struggle for food sovereignty through sustainable agriculture. Monsanto has donated to Haiti tons of unwanted hybrid corn seeds and vegetable seeds. Small farmers are organizing to oppose these plans and to promote their own sustainable solutions instead. You take the C train to Lafayette Station. Further information, area code 917-378-2192. Once again, this Saturday, Chauvin Jean-Baptiste himself would be there, and I hope his brother Basile, I suspect he'll be there as well. They will be there for a very special community presentation Saturday, June 12th at 5:30 p.m., Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church, 85 South Oxford Street, Brooklyn, New York. Further information at 917-378-2192. And now there is yet another event or set of events taking place in regard to British Petroleum and the failure of the Obama administration to protect the environment.
Legislation is for the people, not corporate interests. Join NYH2O and MoveOn.org to send a message to Congress, the Obama administration, and New York State legislators. Our natural resources and elections are not for sale. Meet us at Union Square South, just above 14th Street, Thursday, June 10th at 4 p.m. If you'd like to volunteer, please arrive at 3:30 p.m. Learn what you can do about protecting our state and country from further influence of unregulated industries and how to support fair elections. Featuring speakers from NYH2O, MoveOn.org, and Borough President Scott Stringer. For more information, call 917-297-7700. That's 917-297-7700.
Thank you. Reggie Johnson, engineer here at WBAI, has been very helpful with their own work and with, as you can see, the expansion of the importance of this radio station in various communities. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and or streaming at WBAI.org on the web. My name is Robert Knight, and this program is called Earthwatch. And as I mentioned before, tonight's program is about President Obama's failure at the switch and enabling of the proceedings in the Gulf of Mexico by the notoriously reckless and shamefully unregulated British Petroleum Corporation. This did not happen under George Bush's watch. This was done by Barack Hussein Obama. And we are being given a pretense of supervision. But throughout it all, what Barack Obama did not do was immediately declare a state of emergency. He did not immediately initiate criminal proceedings, thereby giving subpoena power to stop the cover-up that British Petroleum has been engaging in from the very beginning. Because of that lack of supervision, it is now reported that the 7 hours of recorded archives from the doomed refinery, the doomed rig in the Gulf of Mexico, are now missing. This is President Obama's 18-minute gap. 7 hours of what happened just before the explosion are now reported to be missing from the British Petroleum rig. Because there was no subpoena power, there was no investigation of any seriousness taking place. In addition, British Petroleum has been given a green light despite the claims of a moratorium on offshore drilling to proceed this autumn with a 6-mile under the seabed drilling on the northern coast of Alaska. It's called the Liberty Project. So when you hear a press release about a moratorium on drilling, it's not true. The Obama administration is being anything but forthright and honest with us. In addition, I have pored over every piece of evidence I could find, and among the smoking guns are the things we'll hear about in tonight's program. But more than that, I've been reporting for many years on the war, the wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. And people who are kindly disposed to a charming gentleman named Obama often fail to note that he has escalated the war in Afghanistan twice as much as George W. Bush ever did. He has sent 60,000 troops to Afghanistan. Bush only sent 23,000. What's the connection to the Gulf of Mexico? The United States Defense Department, the Pentagon, is going crazy with deals in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Khyber Pass, trying to get enough fuel to run the drones, the F-18s, the bombers that indiscriminately are killing people in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq. And a top contractor for providing that military fuel, for which the Pentagon purchases more than most nations of the world. It's number 35 in the list of national oil and fuel consumers. The Pentagon is. Top contractor for that is British Petroleum. Barack Obama is pussyfooting with BP because he needs them to conduct his crazy war in Afghanistan. That's why things seem irrational about the lack of supervision of the Gulf oil spill and the kid gloves that Obama is using with British Petroleum. He needs them for his dirty war in Afghanistan. My name is Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch. And we're about to hear quite a series of pieces of evidence and this prolegomena as to the investigation, impeachment, and conviction of Barack Obama for Specifications to be determined. We are presenting this, and as I said last week, this is a prolegomena for those not in the academic realm. A prolegomena is not a statement. It is the initiation of a study to establish the worthiness of a study or of an action or of an operation. And the deeper one looks into this, in my experience, the dirtier Obama is looking. Tonight we're going to wonder what the president knew and when he knew it. We are going to look at the highly rehearsed public performance behavior of Barack Obama in the midst of his incompetence and unleashing and then failing to control this situation. We are going to speak with investigative reporters from the Center for Public Integrity and ProPublica, as well as Sky Truth. That is a private organization that independently used satellite monitoring to find out more than the government was telling us about this spill. We'll be speaking with the Center for Public Integrity about how the American public was not made privy to the more reliable and accurate estimates of the dimensions of the spill by the Coast Guard, and how the White House began spinning quite a different narrative and lowballing it. Why was Obama protecting BP? We will speak with ProPublica about the wretched history of British Petroleum in tonight's program. And more than that, we're going to present to you the actual audio of the smoking gun of Obama, not Bush, Obama, unleashing this reckless giant British Petroleum into the Gulf of Mexico and committing ecocide, losing more than a half dozen lives. You know, they also lost 15 people in Texas a few years ago. They had a major spill in Alaska a few years ago. And this is who Obama is going to let do some more dirty work in Alaska. So we're going to hear about that. We're going to hear the actual speech in which Barack Obama cast his die in favor of British Petroleum, resulting into the ecocide that is now upon us. And we begin with a look at how the press and public perceptions are being manipulated by this master performer, Barack Obama. And we can backtrack to how he's now trying to pretend to act like he's angry after 40 days and 40 nights of doing nothing of any significant effect.
He's very calm, cool, collected, but one time, go off. And there's any one time to go off. This is it, because this is a disaster.
I don't sit around just talking to experts because this is a college seminar. We talk to these folks because they potentially have the best answers, so I know whose ass to kick.
Care for me. someone who she can always look up to. You know I love you, of course. Let me know that you're the boss. So Johnny, get angry, Johnny, get mad. Give me the biggest lecture I ever had. I want a great man, I want a caveman. Johnny, show me that you care, really care for me. Johnny, care for me, Johnny. Johnny, 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 Johnny.
I don't sit around just talking to experts because this is a college seminar. We talk to these folks because they potentially have the best answers, so I know who's asked to kick.
Today we're announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration, but in ways that balance the need to harness domestic energy resources and the need to protect America's natural resources. Under the leadership of Secretary Salazar, we'll employ new technologies that reduce the impact of oil exploration. We'll protect areas that are vital to tourism, the environment, and our national security. And we'll be guided not by political ideology, but by scientific evidence. That's why my administration will consider potential areas for development in the Mid and South Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico.
Concerned but not involved. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar.
It is an honor to be here today with President Obama and other leaders who worked so hard to set America free from our dependence on foreign oil. We are here today because Americans have waited long enough for the energy security that they have been promised for decades. We are here to succeed where others have failed by finally cutting America's dependence on foreign oil, building a clean energy economy that is more secure and more prosperous, and protecting our children from the dangers of pollution. Oil, gas, coal, nuclear, sun, wind, geothermal, biofuels, hydropower, they all need to be on the table. So today, as part of our comprehensive energy plan for the country, we are announcing how we will responsibly expand oil and gas exploration and development on the outer continental shelf. Our strategy calls for expanded development and production in new areas such as the eastern Gulf of Mexico, where we can develop resources that are more than 125 miles off of the Florida coast. We're also moving forward with significant new oil and gas exploration in frontier areas, such as the Arctic Ocean and areas in the Atlantic, where we must first determine whether there exists oil and gas reserves, and then secondly, determine if we can develop them appropriately. And we are protecting areas off of our coast like Alaska's Bristol Bay. Our efforts to explore, develop, and protect represent a new direction from the past, a change from the past on the outer continental shelf. After years of lawsuits and political battles, we are bringing much needed order and certainty to our nation's offshore leasing programs. This order and certainty will come from our commitment to ensuring that development occurs in the right places and in the right ways and in a manner that protects our precious environment. That we are making decisions based on sound information and sound science, much of it which still has to be developed. That we are listening to the communities that are most affected by development, and that we are following the law and have an orderly process for exploration and development. These are the principles that will guide our offshore energy future. As the Secretary of Interior, my responsibility is to balance the many values, needs, and uses on the outer continental shelf. I know full well that the decisions we make will affect our prosperity and the availability of affordable domestic energy supplies for years to come. But I also make these decisions knowing our responsibility as an American people to preserve the land, water, and wildlife that have allowed our country to flourish generation to generation. We are fortunate that in these times and this 21st century, as we face all the issues across the world and here domestically, that we have President Obama in place as our leader on all of these efforts. For President Obama understands that to do what is right for the country, we must rise above the political battles of the moment. Energy security is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. It is an American issue. It is an American issue whose time has come. Ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
I think that by the end of his tenure, we're going to know that Ken Salazar is one of the finest Secretaries of Interior we've ever had. So please give him a big round of applause. Other members of what we call our green team are here. Stephen Chu, our Secretary of Energy. Martha Johnson, the Administrator of the GSA. Nancy Sutley, the CEQ Chair. We've got Carol Browner, who's the White House Energy and Climate Change Director. Please give them a big round of applause. They put in a lot of work. You know, Ken and I were colleagues in the Senate, and I appointed him because I knew that he would be a faithful and pragmatic steward of our natural resources. And as Secretary, he is changing the way that the Interior Department does business so that we're responsibly developing traditional sources of energy and renewable sources of energy, from the wind on the high plains to the suns in the desert to the waves off our coasts. And so I'm very grateful to the work that he's done, and culminating in one of the announcements that we're making today. A few weeks ago, I announced loan guarantees to break ground on America's first new nuclear facility in three decades, a project that will create thousands of jobs. And in the short term, as we transition to cleaner energy sources, we still got to make some tough decisions about opening new offshore areas for oil and gas development in ways that protect communities and protect coastlines. Now, this is not a decision that I've made lightly. It's one that Ken and I, as well as Carol Browner, my energy advisor, and others in my administration, looked at closely for more than a year. But the bottom line is this. Given our energy needs, in order to sustain economic growth and produce jobs and keep our businesses competitive, we are going to need to harness traditional sources of fuel, even as we ramp up production of new sources of renewable homegrown energy. So today we're announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration, but in ways that balance the need to harness domestic energy resources and the need to protect America's natural resources. Under the leadership of Secretary Salazar, we'll employ new technologies that reduce the impact of oil exploration. We'll protect areas that are vital to tourism, the environment, and our national security. And we'll be guided not by political ideology, but by scientific evidence. That's why my administration will consider potential areas for development in the Mid and South Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico, while studying and protecting sensitive areas in the Arctic. That's why we'll continue to support development of leased areas off the North Slope of Alaska while protecting Alaska's Bristol Bay. Some of the press may be wondering why we are announcing offshore drilling in a hangar at Andrews Air Force Base. Well, if there's any doubt about the leadership that our military is showing, you just need to look at this F-18 fighter and the light armored vehicle behind it. The Army and Marine Corps have been testing this vehicle on a mixture of biofuels. And this Navy fighter jet, appropriately called the Green Hornet, will be flown for the first time in just a few days on Earth Day. So moving towards clean energy is about our security. It's also about our economy. And it's about the future of our planet. And what I hope is that the policies that we've laid out, from hybrid fleets to offshore drilling, from nuclear energy to wind energy, underscores the seriousness with which my administration takes this challenge.
A private organization known as Sky Truth has been independently monitoring the Gulf of Mexico oil spill using satellites and other technologies. They were the first to note what appears to be a second visible leak or spill in the Gulf. WBAI's Robert Knight spoke with Sky Truth founder and president John Amos.
When the events of April 20th began unfolding, what did you discover?
It became pretty clear to us that that fire wasn't just the 700,000 gallons or so of diesel fuel that they reported on board to fuel the rig. It had to be fed by a much larger source of fuel, and we speculated that was oil and gas actually coming from the well.
As you watched the surface component of the leak from the Deepwater Horizon, I recall that in the early days, you also mentioned almost en passant a second source of oil a little bit to the west of it in the Gulf. Is there more than one leak in the Gulf today?
We're not quite sure yet, but one thing that has happened as a consequence of this BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill is that we're getting an abundance of satellite image coverage of this piece of the ocean like we've never had before. And there are many active oil and gas platforms and pipelines in this area. And back on May 15th, we had noticed what appeared to be a very small potential oil leak, but persistent day in and day out. We saw what appeared to be a small oil slick next to the known location of a platform that was installed back in 1984. So we began to suspect that perhaps there was a small chronic leak from this platform. Possibly there are other explanations for that, that we can't determine definitively just from looking at it from space.
Do you think that the public is being completely informed about the extent?
In the early days, I don't find fault in numbers being inaccurate. But as the spill wore on, it became clear to us, talking to our colleagues in the oceanography community and other scientists in the Gulf region, it became clear that there actually were ways to try to get a more accurate estimate of how much oil was leaking from this well on a daily basis, and that those instruments, those techniques, it seemed they were not being used. And, you know, we were told that it didn't matter how big the spill was. It didn't matter how much oil was coming out on a daily basis because they were doing everything they possibly could and couldn't do anything more. But I found those explanations to be a bit disheartening because at the same time that they're throwing all the cleanup resources at this problem that were available, I was thinking, well, those resources have clearly been overwhelmed. We're overwhelmed early on in this incident. We need to know how big this spill was so that in the future, when we're deciding how big our oil spill response capability has to be, we build it to the right size. So I think it's critically important that we have as accurate a measure of the size of the spill overall and the daily rate of oil, the daily problem that our response crews would have to face to effectively fight that spill to a standstill.
How bad do you think it is, the spill, and how bad can it continue to go over the coming months? And how can people become better informed in order to affect future policy?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, there are some unknowns in there in terms of how, still at this point, unknown exactly how bad this spill is. But the estimates we made back in the first week of this incident, we still think are fairly good estimates, and that's about 1.1 million gallons per day based on the size of the oil slick in the first week of the spill. But I think no matter how good that containment device gets, I think we're really faced with essentially an ongoing major daily spill from this well until they successfully drill a relief well. And they've got two drill rigs working. They're racing each other essentially to see which of the two relief wells can get down to the target and do the job first. But the most optimistic estimates of success for either of those wells is apparently sometime in August. So again, until then, you know, we're looking at a major daily spill coming from this this leak on the seafloor. And what the ultimate consequences of that will be, no one really knows at this point.
John Amos is the president of SkyTruth.org. He spoke with WBAI's Robert Knight.
My name is Aaron Mehta. I'm a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. We're a nonprofit newsroom that's based in D.C., although we have reporters throughout New York and a couple other places. And the stories that we're going to be talking about today are, assuming series of stories that we've done. The main one is on these Coast Guard logs that came out that the center got a hold of that showed kind of the real timeline of what was happening once the rig in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon rig, caught on fire on April 20th. Previously, the real timeline that everyone had is kind of pieced together from news reports and from the official White House timeline, which they posted on their blog. The logs gave a significantly greater detail down, in some cases, to minute-to-minute actions about what the Coast Guard was doing, and in some cases, what the Coast Guard knew about this potential leak.
What's significant here, I think, is that you and the sitter did some fishing, investigative fishing of informational records that perhaps serve the public more than the press releases from the White House and or the British Petroleum Company. What were these documents and how did you get them?
These documents were the Coast Guard's official emergency logs. They're essentially the internal documents from the Coast Guard kept, and they were the first government agency to be on the scene. They were there within minutes once the rig was actually on fire, responding in search and rescue fashion, and later on dealing with kind of the fallout of the rig catching fire, which we all know now is a significant amount of oil spilling out into the Gulf. We heard about these documents from a source that we had heard about a different story that we did that dealt with training exercises that were supposed to prepare the government for a situation like this. We did a story on that in early May, heard about the fact that these logs existed, and with the help of Representative Issa, who's from California, a California Republican on the House Oversight Committee, managed to get her hands on them and basically spent a couple of days just poring through them. And there's about 90 pages, and there's a lot of information there. You can actually check out the logs on our website, which is publicintegrity.org.
How do these records diverge from what we've been fed in public statements? It would seem to indicate that perhaps the Coast Guard was not as flat-footed or off base as the erroneous reports we've been given minimizing the extent of the leakage. What do these documents tell us?
Well, the thing that really caught our attention when we first started looking at these things is that within 24 hours, there's reports of an oil slick on the water. There's been at least two attempts by drone to shut down the well, knowing that the blowout preventer, which is supposed to prevent a leak in case of, you know, in a situation like this, had failed. And again, within 24 hours, they were being warned that there was as much as 8,000 barrels a day of oil spilling into the Gulf. For a long time, it took a bunch of days before even the reports that there's 1,000 barrels coming out. And then that was raised about a week later to 5,000 barrels. This was really the first time that we found that anyone was saying 8,000 barrels within 24 hours, and that hadn't been reported before.
This is one of those what did the president know and when did he know it moments, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked to the White House, and one of the White House spokesmen said that the president was aware pretty quickly in the April 22nd meeting, just about 2 days after the fire on the rig, that Ken Salazar told the president that this could become a major oil spill. What was interesting about that is we were only told that after we came to the White House with these logs. We hadn't actually seen that anywhere. And, in fact, the White House official timeline didn't mention that. What we've been told by the White House, their spokesman, was that the timeline included a disclaimer at the bottom saying it's not meant to be comprehensive. But, you know, if the White House did know all this, then there's a question of why it wasn't on that timeline to begin with.
Let's just reiterate or perhaps even extend the details about the divergence between the minimizing statements that were given to the public from the two sources, or perhaps they are operating as one, that is to say, the White House and British Petroleum, and how the presumably knowledgeable expert speaker of oceanic language information from the Coast Guard got mutated into the minimizing of the leak. How did that happen, and what were the differences in the two accounts?
The differences are essentially a level of detail, which is that, you know, if, and we actually have a great graphic on our website, again, which is publicintegrity.org, which you can kind of track what the White House timeline said versus what the Coast Guard details were saying. But really, the White House log says that there's no apparent leak discovered. It's the term they keep using, no apparent leak, until the 24th, at which point they say there's a leak. And then by the next day, there's 48-mile by 39-mile staying on the Gulf waters. There's reports in the Coast Guard already as of April 23rd, 3 in the morning. They're using disparates. They're saying that there's a 16-mile, square mile sheen on the water. And in fact, at one point, the Coast Guard on the 23rd raised their estimate from 5,000 barrels to 64 to 110,000 barrels a day, which is greater even than a lot of the estimates that have come out and are considered the current estimates.
You mentioned the dispersants. Was there transparency on the use of them and the consequences that are perhaps not as favorable as British Petroleum claimed in insisting that was the best thing to do?
Well, the White House on the 22nd says that they the phrase they use is pre-positioned 100,000 gallons of disparants and okayed with the EPA for their use. And the first disparant mention that we have is that they dropped 15,000 gallons on the 23rd very quickly after that. There wasn't a lot of reporting done on this initially because there seemed to be a sense that there was a fire and for whatever reason it wasn't being covered up or covered by the media as a major leak yet. And the disparant use kind of seems to track with that. There's a little bit going on. Once there's a leak discovered, there is a significant jump in the use in disparants.
There are a great many consequences that can flow, pardon the expression, from this incident. And I'm wondering if the apparent public relations minimizing of the extent of the incident could conceivably be used in the future to reduce liability.
That's, again, not something that's really brought up in the Coast Guard logs. I'm more concerned directly with handling the situation at the time. There is some talk in there about kind of the media attention that's being dealt with and trying to corral the media and how to deal with that, keep specifically false rumors that have come out, if they rescued people, if they hadn't rescued people, trying to keep a lid on that. But there's not much talk about the liability inside these logs.
What do you think the situation is today with the Coast Guard and any other agencies of the government that may attempt to be independent of the mainstream release of information about this story? Is the Coast Guard active today in monitoring, for instance, the subsurface plumes? What is the Coast Guard doing today?
To tell you the truth, I'm not an expert on that, so I'm going to have to slightly pass on that. I can say that from what we've heard, the Coast Guard is working still pretty much around the clock trying to do their best to control the situation.
Well, you have done a great service in bringing a specificity in regard to the early unfolding of this great environmental disaster or tragedy. And what are you and the center working on now? What do you think is the next step for this? We seem to be faced with an unstoppable flow, regardless of the extent of it, and a potential ecocide in many quarters that could spread even up the Atlantic coast, according to some weather and current predictors. Where do you think we are today, and what is the Center for Public Integrity looking at?
Well, I can fortunately can't give you too many details because we have a couple of stories in the works that we don't want to spoil for everyone. We should have another story or two up related to the oil spill either Friday morning or Monday morning. I can say, again, if you go to publicintegrity.org, we have a couple of stories that we've done on with this, including one that some of my colleagues did that found that 97% of the worst industry violations, according to a government database, occur at BP refineries.
That's an issue that I also have been investigating and reporting on, and I'm a bit concerned, I must say, frankly, because I have found pretty much the same kind of statistics, and yet over these years that BP has been reckless with safety considerations and antagonistic against whistleblowers, for some odd reason, it was never debarred by the Environmental Protection Agency. What do you think that is?
Again, I'm going to have to pass on that one, unfortunately. I'm relatively new to the Environmental Protection Agency issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are aware that British Petroleum has been given an exemption, a pass, a continuation of its project at the Liberty oil field in northern Alaska, which is equally extensive in its ambitions, a 5 or 6 mile under the seabed drilling project. Are there people raising alarms or concerns about whether there is a guarantee of safety such as was lacking with Deepwater Horizon.
My understanding is that there are some, there's plenty of great environmental reporting out there, and the articles I've seen have been great in there. Unfortunately, I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. I can say that the center is looking into doing a story on that, but at this point, we're not ready to go to print with it.
Well, as a colleague, I understand that, and I am just as proud of your work as I am jealous. You're doing a tremendous job.
Well, I really appreciate that.
And once more, let's tell the folks how they can stay right on top of the news with the reporting that's being done by your organization.
Sure. If you go to www.publicintegrity.org, you can get our website. We're also all over Twitter and Facebook. You can just do a quick search for us and you'll find us that way.
Aaron Mehta, you're doing a great job. I look forward to the ongoing revelations of your investigations. And thank you and my regards to all of your colleagues.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. I'm Robert Knight, Senior National Correspondent at WBAI, and this is Earthwatch.
My name is Ryan Knutson. I'm a news reporter at ProPublica, and I've been working with lead reporter Abram Lustgarten on looking at BP's safety culture throughout its operations in the United States, in Alaska, in California, in Texas. We got our hands on some internal investigations and also looked at some external ones as well, and all of them seem to point to a company that has repeatedly cut corners when it comes to maintenance and process safety for the sake of production. One of these studies interviewed 250 workers, and all of these workers expressed concerns that they weren't necessarily comfortable raising concerns about safety concerns and that sort of stuff. That if they had stopped production or pointed out things that might be hazardous, that they would be punished.
The event in the Gulf of Mexico of April 20th is not unique in the history of British Petroleum, is it? There is another fatal explosion that you researched. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, BP has been involved in some of the biggest catastrophes in recent memory in the United States. In 2005, 15 workers were killed at the Texas City refinery in Texas City, Texas. Numerous investigations that came out after that found that BP had a culture of noncompliance and that managers were cutting corners, and that a lot of this stuff was, it wasn't, deliberate to try to kill the workers, but this stuff was, I was part of a culture of cutting corners, I guess.
One of the other incidents that has happened with British Petroleum is, I believe, a spill from the storage facilities of a pipeline in Alaska?
Yeah, there was 200,000 gallons of oil spilled in Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. And that's an area where one of the internal investigations was conducted. That report found that there was longstanding cultural safety problems, and that there was poor communication and mistrust, and that BP had reduced staff and training budgets, and so workers felt that they couldn't adequately shut down do emergency shutdown procedures and things like that. And that wasn't even the first spill there was a case from the mid-90s where BP admitted that it had illegally dumped waste into the ocean.
You speak of a risk and a culture of suppression for whistleblowers. How does that work?
Well, one of the workers that we spoke with, he was working on a line, and he discovered in a pipeline in Alaska, he discovered a hole that was leaking some methane gas, and nearby there was workers that were working on the pipe, and they the work that they were doing was causing sparks to fly in the air, and he told them to stop, and he shut down production because if the methane gas that was leaking caught one of these sparks, he said it could have been an unbelievable explosion that would have been even larger than the Texas City explosion from 2005. But the next day, he was singled out by his managers and harassed for stopping production rather than congratulating you know, being congratulated for doing something that brought was safe for the company.
How does then this history of spillages, of shortcuts, of risks, and internal suppression of, I guess, dissent or whistleblowing or remediation, how does all of that converge into the lesser-known events of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion of the 20th of April 2010?
Yeah, these reports that we looked at, you know, obviously, I mean, they didn't, you know, say in the Gulf, you know, or anything like that, but they really sort of point to a culture that puts a strong emphasis on, you know, cost savings along the way. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we're learning about from this explosion in the Gulf now is showing that this was happening again. You know, the notion that they were filling the drilling well with seawater rather than drilling mud, which is lighter, but it also saved them several million dollars, and they were may have used some sort of a shortcut from Halliburton's instructions about how to secure the drilling well and various things like that, and also not a strong sense of what kinds of procedures to undergo when things are going wrong.
There's got to be some kind of control over the system, and yet it appears there has not been. For instance, the Environmental Protection Agency, is it not charged with the responsibility of, well, protecting the environment? What has been the nature of the relationship between BP and EPA, and not just during the Bush years, during these critical Obama years, too?
Well, there's, you know, some of the people that we've spoken to who used to be in the EPA are saying that they don't think that the EPA is doing as thorough of an investigation in the beginning as it should have been. Now, that's hard to pinpoint because a lot of this stuff is, you know, it's not public when they're doing, when government agencies begin investigations. You know, criminal proceedings are, you know, often, you know, exempt from the public eye. So it's kind of hard to tell that at this point. I know that there has, I mean, the Department of Interior Inspector General came out with a report that examined the Minerals Management Service, which is the regulator for offshore drilling, and found numerous sort of cozy relationships, and that the regulator wasn't really fully doing its job. I mean, one thing that we came across is with the Minerals Management Service is that it relies heavily on, you know, what's known as categorical exclusions, which is when you apply for to drill, they are normally supposed to do a very extensive multi-year study on what the possible environmental impacts would be. But the regulating agency was just sort of using this process that fast tracks that and just says, well, we don't think that there's going to be any major environmental impacts from this, so we're just going to say that it's fine. We don't need to do a big study looking at what environmental impacts there might be because, well, you know, we sort of know that they don't really exist is kind of what those say. And that's what the Deepwater Horizon rig got, as well as 250 to 400 other drilling applications a year.
Ryan, why cannot the President of the United States direct the agencies or himself issue executive instructions that there be a rigorous pursuit of environmental and safety regulations and protection?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that the president has made indications to make major changes to the regulatory apparatus. I mean, he's already announced that they're going to be splitting the Minerals Management Service into two, maybe even three parts. Right now, the regulator, the Minerals Management Service, it's both in charge of making sure that the industry is paying the government royalties that it should be, as well as regulating it for safety. So on the one hand, it wants to encourage and promote the oil industry so that it makes money, so that more money goes back to the U.S. government. But at the same time, it's regulating its safety and making sure that it's doing things correctly. And so people felt that that's sort of an opposing you know, sort of opposing objectives when you want it to make money, but you also want it to be safe, that maybe the safety side of it is sort of taking a back seat.
The impression I got is that BP is such a repeated transgressor of regulations and safety procedures that it was threatened with being debarred by the Environmental Protection Agency. Why has that not happened?
That's a really good question, actually. I mean, on the one hand, debarment is supposed to be in the best interest of the United States. It's not necessarily supposed to be a method of punishment. So you can look at, well, you've got to consider the impact on the economy if this company were to no longer be able to do business with the government. It also, British Petroleum supplies fuel to the military. That's one thing that they've got to consider. But, I mean, they were debarred. The Texas City refinery itself, you know, that one particular location was subject to debarment and also probation. Now, you know, how that actually impacts BP, if one of its refineries, it's got five in the United States, debarred, is sort of open to speculation.
You've done a tremendous amount of research, and for that, I think the world is grateful. And I'd like to just project it into future potentialities. And despite the president's announcement of what many people would construe as a moratorium on offshore drilling, one of the projects that is still under a green light is yet another stretching of the envelope of technology project, just as the Horizon mile-deep drilling was in the Gulf of Mexico, one that goes horizontally under the seabed in the northern slope of Alaska, the Liberty drilling project, and that is also being run by British Petroleum. Does that arouse any alarms, and what are the potential hazards of that, and do we know that the government will be any more effective in enforcing safety than it has been in the past?
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, a lot of this, a lot of what has happened now is something of an indication of what's been happening forever, is that the industry is always more advanced technologically than government can possibly regulate, because, I mean, the money is in the private sector, and so these companies are always pushing the envelope to go deeper and farther and faster for more profit. And so the government regulators are trying to keep up. I mean, just in the last 20 years, the offshore drilling has gotten much deeper. I guess, you know, in the 1980s, they were drilling in 1,500 feet of water, sort of testing around with 5,000 feet, and now they're into 10,000 feet. And the technology is advancing very quickly, but the amount of people who are knowledgeable enough to know what was going on, it's not really adequate. I mean, there was a story in the New York Times a bit ago that was talking about how, I guess this is in the Inspector General's report about the Minerals Management Service. One thing that it uncovered was that some of these regulators who were visiting these oil rigs in the Gulf, they were having people on the rig fill out the inspection reports and then in pencil, and then the regulators would go over the reports in a pen after the fact. I mean, that's just sort of a sign that the people who are working in the industry have more technical knowledge than do the regulators, and so the regulators oftentimes just don't really know what's really going on.
Final question. Is there more needed from the current administration in order to guarantee future safety?
One place to look is in the North Sea in Europe, where there were some accidents there in the 80s, which, I mean, they're known to have a lot of regulation, and, you know, I haven't looked into this very thoroughly, but also not as many serious accidents as in the United States. So, I mean, in deciding, because, you know, some people might say that if you let the industry sort of knows best, and if its motivation to avoid catastrophes like this is, you know, when they happen, like they do in the Gulf. But it'd be interesting to compare the safety record and then in the North Sea, which has a lot of regulation compared with what's happened in the United States.
Brian, I thank you very much for the work that you and your colleagues are doing at ProPublica, and I'd like to just take this chance for you to name the seminal report that you've done and how people can be in touch for further detailed enlightenment on their own.
Well, you can read this story on our website, propublica.org. That's propublica.org. We've got some of the documents that we use for our story. It was co-published with the Washington Post, but they published a slightly shorter version. And we've been following what's been going on in the Gulf very comprehensively. Marion Wang, our blogger, has been writing quite a bit. So if you go to our site and you can click along the top there, we've got a tab for Gulf Spill, and we've got all of our stories up there. So check it out.
Well, thank you, Ryan. We're going to be in touch in the coming days and weeks, and going to be on this thing like oil on a bird, man.
All right, great. Well, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Oil and gas development in ways that protect communities and protect the transition to cleaner energy sources, we still got to make some tough decisions about opening new offshore areas for oil and gas development in ways that protect communities and protect coastlines. Now, this is not a decision that I've made lightly. It's one that Ken and I, as well as Carol Browner, my energy advisor, and others in my administration, looked at closely for more than a year. But the bottom line is this. Given our energy needs, in order to sustain economic growth and produce jobs and keep our businesses competitive, we are going to need to harness traditional sources of fuel, even as we ramp up production of new sources of renewable homegrown energy. So today we're announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration, but in ways that balance the need to harness domestic energy resources and the need to protect America's natural resources. Under the leadership of Secretary Salazar, we'll employ new technologies that reduce the impact of oil exploration. We'll protect areas that are vital to tourism, the environment, and our national security. And we'll be guided not by political ideology, but by scientific evidence. That's why my administration will consider potential areas for development in the Mid and South Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico, while studying and protecting sensitive areas in the Arctic.
Oh. seen beneath the ocean. A fish species scientist explorer, having traveled the seven seas and thereby having knowledge of Earth land, is communicating the concept of a Darwinian theory to other sea creatures and members of the fish and sea family gathered there to hear him. He speaks and says,
"Board of fishdom, sea creatures and all included in oceanic membership, I know it's hard to conceive, but you must believe there is beyond our watered sky a place where the spirits of our ancestors dwell, called hell. They're fearful looking creatures there, with features bearing no resemblance to the fin-like ways of us. They're monstrous, with no evidence of ever having been akin with fin. Their skin, no scales, breathing pure oxygen. They live on land. Can you understand the horror of their chains? Strange how they used to be as we, members of the fish species. They call themselves now humankind. And as they live, they leave behind them devastation, horrible annihilation of all the others here to share the earth as brothers. They live as demons, and they try, if you should go too near our watered sky, to sneer you and spear you and tear you with their hooks and drag you to their atmosphere of, to us, suffocating air. Creatures that are there to fly are being driven from their sky, polluted by the acrid vapors of the selfish human capers. Everything that grows with beauty has become the sacred duty of the human to destroy. So woods are fallen, burned, and broken as a token added to the misery of the human history. The fish species once, they're now returning to the sea, I fear. Oh, children, listen to me. We must not allow them here. They have built machines and are exploring far and deep. And soon they'll come to dwell, bringing with them hell and other human horrors. So beware. Prepare to protect the life we live here in our sea. We must gather all together and be an impossibility for them to penetrate. If we concentrate, we can be stronger than the human. So fish and whales and octopi and the demons of the deep and the mermen, maids, and myths and monsters, rise up from your sleep. Come together now and join the seaweed and the plants and plankton. Gather moss, elements and currents. Ride them roughly should they try to dry us dead with their their chicanery. And instead, destroy them, winds of outraged nature, lest they change the nomenclature of the universe. Oh, stop them! Let us stop them with our passion, should they try their fearful fashion of expand and conquer on us. Let us dwell and wash them all away for good, and clean the earth of what they wrought as cruel men. And then we'll start again and be a world ruled by for the fish species. Sea creatures that are all included in oceanic membership. I know it's hard to conceive, but you must believe. There is beyond our borders about their ancestors. A place to are none other than the spirit of our ancestors dwell.
Did you recognize yourself there, fellow?
Fellow human!
Voice of the Voiceless, Fish Species, from the Gulf of Mexico, rendered by Lincoln Chase, here today on Earthwatch, on WBAI in New York, and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Robert Knight.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning is Daniel Jose Holder, author of Salsa Nocturna, musician, and soon to be, with your help, editor. Stay tuned.
everyone says I love you. The great big mosquito when he's stinging you. The fly when he gets stuck on the fly paper too says I love you. Every time the cow says moo, she's making Whoopie very happy too. The rooster in the barnyard singing cock-a-doodly-doo says I love you. Christopher Columbus, he write the Queen of Spain a very nice little note. And he's right, I love you, baby. And then he gets himself a nice a big boat. He's a wise guy, what do you think Columbo do? When he's coming here in 1492, he says to Pocahontas, what you got, you got, you goo. That means, you little son of a gun, I love you. There are only 8 little letters in this phrase you'll find, but they mean a lot more than all the other words combined. Everywhere, the whole world through, the king in the palace and the peasant too, the tiger in the jungle and the monkey in the zoo says I love you.
You'd almost be thinking if there were a woman in a which Marx Brothers movie has that song in it. I don't recall, but it's one where everybody is doing it. Oh, please forgive. God, I turn on my guest mic and all of this noise in the background from the hallway. Listen to this, gang. Do you hear that? You know, not only are you hearing the sounds of WHCR, you know, within whose confines we are sharing a basement portion of CCNY, but you hear this alarm noise, and nobody seems to know.
Yeah, that's annoying.
It really is. And when it's on the air, it's even better.
So I can only imagine.
So this is how people know whether I've pre-recorded my show at home.
Right.
Like I did last week. Because when I'm on mic from home, it sort of sounds, you know, like I'm swallowing the mic. And then the interview hopefully sounds okay. Versus being live here. Now, this week I'm live here because we have Daniel Jose Older as our guest. Next week, Rick Bowes will be here live. The week after that will be a program at the interview, at least, with Catherine Lundoff, was recorded at Barwell Studios. So we will hear how that comes up. But I will probably come here to present it live. Now, before we talk about any of those things, we have to talk about, well, the potential survival of this radio station. I mean, you really ought to see, or maybe you shouldn't, the conditions in which we're operating down here.
It's better they don't see it, I think.
Better
they miss it.
Yeah, on the other hand, seeing it might cause them to donate.
I know I'm going to after this experience.
But having moved out of 120 Wall Street and coming up here to Harlem, to a lovely neighborhood, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, when you're traveling from Brooklyn, the neighborhood is lovely. The subway, not so much.
Not at all.
Yeah, really.
It's a distance.
But it's a distance, and then we come to these facilities that, despite the work of a whole like 3 or 4 people who have been tasked with turning this space into a station where they don't even acknowledge that it is WBAI, Max and I, just before the program, actually went, you know, taking WHCR little triangles off the microphone saying, we're paying for this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is mm-hmm. WBAI. And so that counts for 2 out of the 3 mics in this room. And then, on top of that, you hear the noise. All of this has to be taken care of. Now, yes, we're spending less. We were paying $33,000 a month up at 120 Wall Street. Now, this space doesn't come for free. We're paying somewhere between $5,000 or $6,000 a month over here.
So, you know, not to mention the cost of the move itself, plus whatever storage facility half the equipment is in. But that's not all there is, you see. There's this other room that we have to pay for, and it is called the transmitter. And the address is a very easy one to figure out. It's in the Empire State Building. And if we do not have a transmitter on the Empire State Building, we are not broadcasting. And that costs upwards, or actually over, $50,000 a month. So we have gone into the emergency WBAI transmitter fund with the absolutely impossible task of raising $250,000 by March 31st. Well, lo and behold, we've made it. So much for its being impossible. But then, April 1st, guess what? The next month's rent is due. April 1st, another $50,000. And guess what happens May 1st? You guessed it. Same thing, June, July, August. And then, oh yeah, I mentioned Max. And Sydney's here too. These guys are what they call payroll. Well, that means they don't, not that they roll for their pay, but that somebody's got to pay them so that they can do the editing, the engineering, the work that needs to be done to keep a radio station going. There's also a station manager and various people who think that for working 70, 80 hours a week, they deserve money. I'm not sure why that is, but, you know, 80 hours a week, you know, they ought to get a subpar salary. The point is, we're not done. Our thon is not done. Our fundraising is not done. We had a benefit tonight at SOB, Sound of Brazil, which from what I could tell by looking at it afar from Facebook, I couldn't be there because I had to prepare for here, and I had a conflict with tonight. But, yeah, as far as I can tell, now I know I'm supposed to say everything's crap, it's going poorly. I'm sorry to say it went well.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Well, how about that? Yeah.
I'm
and
happy about that.
We're making the money that we're making, but we're doing it only because when we do pitches like the one you're hearing at this very moment, people respond. And that is why we're asking you to call right now to donate to the WBAI Transmitter Fund at area code 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. Or you can go to the web, and you can go to a specially designated web page, which is, now don't type this in yet because it's weird, okay? It's okay, the concept is simple. Give to WBAI.org, except that it's the numeral 2. It's give number 2, WBAI.org. And if you go there, you can donate $5, $10, $25, whatever it may be, and that will help us along. Okay, you can hear the people going into HCR, right?
It's like a party in the background.
Yeah, well, it is a party in the background.
It's like